Hey guys, thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of Sheer Crime. I'm Amy.
And I'm Kenzie.
And today for episode 19, we're going to be discussing the HBO documentary Thought Crimes, The Case of the Cannibal Cop. Now this story explores the anonymity of late night cyber rooms dedicated to dark fetishes and the depravity of the human mind. Some might say, behind the privacy of your computer screen, the keyboard allows the real you to come out and play, engaging in fantasies that would normally turn your stomach. Now, this case looks at former police officer Gilberto Valle, who hunted bad guys during the day and women at night. Lock your doors and check that browser history, because this story is about to make you question more than just his intentions. Well, hi.
Hello.
It's Thursday again.
It's Thirsty Thursday.
It is Thirsty Thursday. And while I won't be drinking.
You won't.
Hashtag tear. But I've got my little mini Dr. Pepper here with me. What are you drinking?
Well, today I'm going back to our tried and true Crook and Marker.
Yes.
And I'm drinking the strawberry lemon flavor.
Ugh.
Of course, a fave. I just can't get myself away from them now.
Seriously, my mouth just watered.
I know. Come on. Crook and Marker, sponsor us, please.
Right? My sister actually messaged me the other day and said, I am on the Crook and Marker train. I'm like, we're doing it. So we need to start hashtagging them, I think.
I think we should, especially since we drink them so often.
I know. We need to start making a note that this was a Crook and Marker episode.
Yes, we do.
And start hashtagging
them. Yes, we do.
All right. Let's pop those tops.
Let's pop it.
Nice.
That was perfection, as always.
As always.
That's so good.
I bet.
This one is definitely my favorite.
I feel like that one was my favorite, too.
Well, and I just in general, like the Crook and Marker brand is so smooth.
Yes.
Out of any single other one I've had, we've tried them all, really.
Right, yeah.
This is the best, by far.
For real. We need our own, like, flavor.
We do.
I feel like we need our own flavor. And I feel like we could come up with one pretty well.
Yes, we could. Yes. Oh, we'll have to think about that. We'll have to think about a good mix and name.
Yeah. Well, now that you're drinking for two.
I am.
You know, because I can't. I'm drinking for two, but in a different way. I wanted to take this opportunity to ask any of those listening, if you have a few seconds and you've heard our episodes before and you already love them, if you could go out to iTunes and rate and review us real quick. It literally takes like 60 seconds.
Yeah.
It's super, super quick. And if you have not listened to an episode of ours before, why don't you listen to this one first?
Yeah.
Because at the end, I guarantee you're going to want to go rate and review us.
Yes. And if you have an iPhone, you can also review on the Apple Podcast app. That's super easy too as well. You can rate us and then also write even a one sentence review.
Yeah.
Goes a long way and really helps with our standings.
It does.
In the app.
Yeah. I mean, because we're kind of killing it.
I think so, too.
For being pretty new, I feel like we're doing pretty well.
I think so, too.
We're almost at 8,000 downloads.
We are in about 4 months.
That's insane.
And we owe it all to you guys.
All to you guys. Do you remember when we were super excited when we hit 100?
Yes, I do.
Oh, my gosh. I was like watching it constantly for that first like week.
I know. Me, too.
Oh, that was so fun. I mean, it's still fun.
Of course.
All right. So this story is kind of interesting.
Yes, to say the least.
Yes. It's interesting because there is a bit of a crime aspect to it. However, no crime was actually committed.
Right.
So this kind of goes into almost a scary kind of dystopian look at how the world could be if we allow things to unfold in certain ways.
Right.
So I think since I have been talking a lot already, I am already sick of my voice. Why don't you get us started off?
I will, yes.
All right.
So this documentary starts off with a reporter and some breaking news. A New York City police officer has been arrested in a failed plot to kidnap dozens of women, cook them, and then eat them.
Yes, you heard that.
And this was breaking news.
Yes.
This was all over radio stations and TV.
In New York.
That's
so
right.
So we're not talking some small town, you know, podunk situation.
No, this is New York City, and this has to do with a New York City police officer.
Right.
We find out it's Gilberto Valle. They coin him as the cannibal cop, and we find out that he's 28 years old. We also find out his wife was the one who ratted him out and uncovered this entire plot.
Yeah.
Now, he was charged in conspiracy to commit kidnapping and using his work computer to locate potential victims.
What the fuck?
That is scary.
That is so scary.
Because there's so much power there.
Yep.
They know everything. And that system, it's supposed to keep us safe. But when
Absolutely.
You have someone deranged.
Yep. Using it out of context.
Yes, it is scary. Now, his defense lawyers are saying that this was just sexual fantasies. Like, he would never act on it. But was it really just thoughts, or had he actually planned to do this? And that is kind of the question we go back and forth on this entire episode.
Yep.
It's a really gray, fine line between how do you know if they wouldn't act on it, especially
yeah.
to the extent that he goes to in these chats and these conversations with these people.
The description is there.
It's, it's tough.
Yeah, I would not have enjoyed being a jury member.
No. And going into detail.
Because they get the transcripts. They get all of it.
They do, yes.
We get excerpts.
That's right.
Yeah.
We first meet Robert Kolker, and he's from the New York Magazine. And he tells us that people are fascinated with serial killers, as we know.
Hands up. They're playing my song.
Yep. We are one of those people. Come on. And I think it's because of that curiosity we have behind what goes on in their mind and what made them do these crimes and these heinous things,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, we all want to look for that point of impact.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like, where did this stem from?
Right.
Now, not only did it seem like Gil was planning on killing and eating his wife and other women, he was a police officer. It's almost unbelievable. And that's what I think makes it that much scarier.
Agreed.
If this was a man who just had a normal everyday job, say he was a construction worker or
accountant
what have
or
you,
something.
Yeah, yeah. Just a standard job that didn't have authority behind it. It's still disturbing,
yep.
but it doesn't get to this level of very scary because he's in a power position.
Yep.
And he's could use it for bad things.
Yeah, he has tools available to him that the normal person doesn't.
Right.
And that makes it even scarier.
And people automatically trust police, right?
I was going to say, and he's hiding behind a badge.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. But of course, we always know that there are two sides to every single story.
Sure.
Now, Robert tells us that Julia Gatto, who was the lead defense attorney in Gil's case, had even stated that it was a thought police case. And Robert said that that's when everything got much more interesting.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
We do meet Gilberto Valle at age 30. He doesn't seem to be in prison. He seems to be at a normal interview in a house.
Yep.
So it's a telltale sign. It's one of the things I always notice whenever we actually get to see, even though they're the charged person, they're charged with this crime, you kind of know that they're not in prison. So you kind of get an inkling of how this is going to end, right?
Yeah.
Now, he tells us that there's a lot of myths and that people tend to learn a single version of a story and really lean on that side of the story.
Are you kidding?
Of course.
What? That happened?
And then they try and find the things to support it.
Absolutely.
But the things that don't support it, they brush off to the side.
Yeah, because it doesn't go with their theory.
Exactly. Yep. Gil is telling us that he wants people to look at all of the facts before coming to their own conclusion about what really was happening. And as having seen this documentary all the way through.
Yeah.
Really,
I feel like it's really, really
iffy.
Fishy.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting for him to say that, but I mean, even from an outsider looking in, still a little tough. So
it is tough, yeah.
Gil tells us that he grew up in Queens. His parents divorced when he was really, really young. And his mom was the loving mom, caring, affectionate. And his dad was that strict, kick you in the butt, make sure you're doing things right kind of dad.
So we get to meet his parents. First on the screen is Gil Valley Sr., his dad. And he says that, you know, as a parent, when something like this comes up with your child, the first thing you start to wonder is like, is he crazy? What is wrong with my son?
Because this is so strange and really dark.
Very dark. And we see more of it later on in the documentary, but this, he grows up in a very like centralized Catholic upbringing.
Yep.
Which also, I believe, pulls even more into the story. And I'll have some things to say about in a little bit.
I agree.
But so, dad is just kind of like, where did he come up with this stuff? Because it seems so off the wall.
And it seems like he's almost in disbelief. He does not believe it. He's shocked. He's like, that's not the kid I knew.
Right.
Like, where did this come from? And it, again, I think I would feel the same way.
Oh, yeah. 100%. So Liz Valley, his mom, comes on and she says she could not believe it. No way was it her son. She had noticed at one point, like, maybe her son had a problem. Looking back, maybe there was something that pointed to this. She said it was absolutely horrible to see the chats and how he had been discussing women in the way that he was discussing them online. She thinks that he may need some help, whether it be psychiatry, therapy, something. This isn't normal in her mind.
It's not, because some of the things he was saying was things such as flawless abduction, making chloroform, looking tasty.
Yeah.
And again, he's speaking about women looking tasty. Okay. Yeah. So, and that's not even the worst of it.
That's not.
It's not.
No. And she also goes on to say, like, you know, could this maybe be a way of him releasing some of his frustrations? Some people go to the gym. Yep. Some people go on a punching bag. Maybe he went on these chat rooms.
Yeah. I do believe that this could be a form of stress relief for people. I totally agree with that.
Yeah.
I've never seen something so deranged before. But again, we don't do things like that. So it's almost hard for us to believe as well. But there are people that do that. And I can see that as being truthful.
Yeah. Well, and I think the part that really speaks to me as to why this specific situation is a little bit different than, like, say, your average guy going online and, or girl, you know, going online and having these types of discussions that are just so out of the normal, what we consider normal sexual realm.
Right.
Is the fact that the women he discusses, you guys, are all women that are part of his life. He knows them personally. Ugh. So they're not just an abstract thought of a woman.
Or a made up person.
Right. These are all real people that he knows and has thought about in these ways, which I think takes it to another level.
Well, and why I think it made it as far as it did in the trial.
Agreed.
I think that had to, of course, be one of the main reasons, because these were real people that he can harm and he knows where these people live.
Right.
So it makes it more real.
Yeah. Yeah. It looks more like they are prey versus, not. We go back to his dad and he says he believes his son was just a really good writer, which, okay, fine.
I think it's a little bit of an excuse, but
I think it's an excuse too.
And I think it's his way of coping with it and dealing with it, you know, is thinking that it's storytelling.
Agreed.
You know, but to each their own. And if that's the way he deals with it, I mean, good on him. I mean, he has to get through it somehow too, because this is a lot for his parents to deal with as well.
Right.
This came out of left field and now they're in the spotlight. Everyone knows where they live, when they're going to be outside.
Yep.
You know what I mean? Like, now their life has completely turned upside down and they were blindsided.
Yeah. So we actually get to meet a real writer, Daniel Engber, and he says that during all of this, Gil had been in his apartment while his wife and baby slept in the very next room. He's online talking about slitting her throat, specifically her throat.
Yeah.
But how close to the real crime was he? There was no real attempt, right? So he never actually walked into the bedroom with a knife.
No.
You know, none of that happened. Upon inspecting his computer, there had been 24 separate conversations. In 21 of them, he was asked by the other person involved in the conversation if this was for real. And he answers things like, no, I'm just talking fantasy. it's just make-believe.
Right.
So yep. He's very honest, like, no, this isn't real what I'm talking to you about. This is just fantasy.
Right. And I'm like, oh, okay, well, that's kind of good news, right?
Right, right. However, three of them, he would say, yes, for real. And things like, quote, if I were guaranteed to get away with it, I would do it. That's where there could have been some evidence for a conspiracy.
Right. And it's interesting that his answer was not consistent throughout all these chats.
Yeah.
Why did he pick these three people to say that to? Did he get closer with them?
That's what I'm thinking.
You know, did he have a different type of conversational relationship with these people? Because it seems odd, because for the most part, he was telling them that it was fantasy. But then these three people, he told them that he's just afraid of getting caught, and yep. He would do it if he could. And he knew he wouldn't get caught, you know? So, I know. We next meet Joseph DeMarco. He is a former federal prosecutor. And he tells us, and I quote, we do not have thought crime in this country. And I said, how would you prosecute something like that? Right?
Right.
We're literally dealing with a case right now where they have to prosecute something that someone was thinking, but never actually did. And I believe that's why we don't have that in this country, because it is so hard to prosecute. There's nothing to prosecute except a thought and data in a computer or things of that nature. You know what I mean? So it's interesting.
We definitely don't prosecute it. We do persecute people for their thoughts, though.
For sure.
Big
for
time.
Sure. That's a totally different topic.
That's big time. So yeah, there is no formal prosecution, but there's a lot of the other.
For sure. For sure. And Joseph goes on to say that it's permissible to have all of the thoughts that Gilberto had, but impermissible to plan with another person to act on those thoughts.
100%.
Right? So there is a difference, of course.
Yeah.
And again, there was a very fine line with what was said between Gil and these other conspirators.
Yep.
You know, I mean, it is very gray and terrifying.
Yeah.
We find out that the two charges brought against Gil were kidnapping conspiracy and unlawful use of a law enforcement database. We meet Alan Dershowitz, who it says he's a lawyer from Harvard Law School. But if any of you guys had followed anything on the Jeffrey Epstein case.
Yeah.
Oh, he's trash. He's trash. I immediately saw him on the screen. I'm like, fucking Dershowitz.
I know.
God damn it. Why is he here? But again, this came out well before the Jeffrey Epstein documentary came out.
That's right. That's right. It did. Yeah.
So they, of course, they mentioned nothing about that. Obviously, at this point, he's just a lawyer.
I had to
Google
it because I was like, how do I know this guy?
Oh, yeah. Oh,
and yeah. I also found out that he was involved with the O.J. Simpson trials and Harvey Weinstein.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. He's a bigwig lawyer.
Yeah.
And really renowned at one point. But now with these charges.
Yeah.
Saying that he was a part of this whole scheme with underage prostitution or whatever it was, that he was a part of it. So, he's trash. That's what I wrote. Side note for y'all.
Yep.
Now, he states that in order to be convicted of an attempt, not only do you need to intend to do it, but you have to go beyond preparation or cross a line that suggests you're going to do it if no one stops you.
Right.
Conspiracy, though, takes that line back a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Because you didn't actually do it, but again, you thought or were conspiring to do it.
Kind of planning.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, if two people talk about doing something terrible and agree to do it and take one overt act, they can be prosecuted and put in jail for the rest of their lives.
Yeah.
We learn what an overt act is. An overt act is the one thing that can be clearly proved by evidence and from which criminal intent can be inferred, as opposed to a mere intention in the mind to commit a crime.
And that means that it doesn't have to be a crime itself. So an overt act wouldn't be, for example, stealing a car to get to a bank that you're planning to rob. That's not exactly what the overt act is. It can just simply be something that has special meaning in the case.
Well, right. And they even said, like, for instance, Gilberto talked about disabling victims with chloroform and then Googled how to make chloroform.
Right.
So the Googling could be that overt act.
Yeah.
Right.
It's taking it that one step past just being a conversation.
Right. Exactly. And then also he had talked about stalking a victim and then they found him look up her address in that law enforcement database.
Yeah.
So that again could be that overt act, right? That he's going to commit a crime.
Yeah. Versus now, actually showing up to her house or actually
exactly.
purchasing the products to make chloroform.
Exactly. Taking more steps than someone just thinking about these
yes.
things, right? You're doing a little bit more than just the actual thinking. Correct.
Yeah.
The one thing I had is like, why the fuck is chloroform even a thing? Like, who uses it? What is it? The only reason I've ever heard of its use is for disabling and making people unconscious.
So, you know, why? The only other time I've ever heard of it was when I was watching the, I think it's like a 4-part series on Casey Anthony. And she talks about, because at one point she Googled how to make chloroform. She brought it up in court that she was trying to use it for her gardening. So there has to be some reason that it's used in gardening.
Is it even still
I'm amazing? Afraid to Google it because I'm afraid someone's going to check my phone and all of a sudden they're going to show up at my house. And
everyone asks how to make it. So it's almost like you can't buy it. So it's like, did they stop making it for the purpose of these criminal acts that were happening? Or
I think it's a compound. I think it's two things that are brought together that make this
Probably.
Product.
Yeah, it's horrible. It needs to go away. Let's not even let
I mean, I know a couple
order.
People I'd like to chloroform. I'm just telling you, but I'm not going to figure out how to do it.
Right, right. Go to that extent, right? That
yeah.
overt act.
This is all in my mind, right? These
there
are just
go.
Fantasies I think about
there
you know,
you go.
When they say something stupid out loud.
Now, Daniel Engber comes back and he tells us that Gil actually traveled to Maryland to visit one of his intended victims, which had been one of his college friends. And this trip to Maryland could seem like a recon mission for this murderous kidnapping plot. And this could be considered that overt act
yeah.
for him. And I totally see that.
I totally
that
see that too.
That is sketchy and scary.
Yeah.
And the sad thing is she had no fucking idea about this until after it all broke the news and everything like that. Can you imagine what her thought process was after that?
Oh, I would be super creeped out because they knew each other from college.
Right.
He had brought his wife and his baby there to like meet her. So we know that they hadn't seen each other in at least like 3-4 years.
Oh, my.
And to think like, ew, was he like part stalking me in college even?
Right.
Like, this has to go back a little ways.
It does. This is not the first time he's probably thought about this.
Right.
How long has this been actually going on?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Spoiler, later on, they tell us 10 years.
Yeah.
That he's been thinking about doing this to her.
Right.
10 fucking years.
Oh.
Ew.
Yeah.
Gross. Which then makes me think there is no way that this is a release from his job from being a cop if he's been thinking about this for that long.
No, it's embedded.
It's deeper than that.
In who he is. You
yep.
know what I mean? It's just something.
Because they try to use that as an excuse.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
High stress job. He needs to get his whatever. Go tug one out and call it a day.
Oh. Now we meet Jane Rosenberg. She was actually the court sketch artist in his trial. And she said that she doesn't normally draw nudes often.
Well, no.
But in this case, she did visuals of women being cooked on spits and pictures of the dark fetish net.
Yeah.
Now, I had to look up what spits were because I was a little bit confused. So I did. And it's actually like that large, sharp metal rod that is like stuck through a piece of meat. Typically, you see like a whole pig.
I think a pig roast.
On one,
yeah.
And it like turns slowly over low heat. Mm-hmm. So it cooks for a long period of time, right? But this was pictures of women on these things
Ugh.
Over fires.
Ugh.
So terrifying.
Yeah.
She says that she's never seen anything like it in a trial before.
No.
Well,
no shit. We know what these like court sketch artists are. I mean, when we see any type of a document or usually it has to do when children are testifying because
right.
they don't usually have cameras on them because
Correct.
They're underage.
They can't. Yep.
They will have court sketch artist renditions of
yeah.
the situation
right.
so that you get an idea. And you've probably seen some in like newspapers before.
Yep, yep.
Like I've totally seen these. So at first I was like, why is she sketching naked people? But then I'm like, oh, I get it. She has to sketch the evidence that they're bringing in.
Right. And it's all over the place.
It's all over the place.
Yeah.
Yikes. Next, we meet Dara Gregorian from the New York Daily News. He says that reporters came in to this trial from all over the country. They said that they had heard a lot about it, but now it was all being laid out in front of them. So yeah, they knew a little bit about it, but now it was like all right there.
Oh, and this piqued so many people's curiosity. Like, holy shit, what happened?
Cannibalism is not something that's taken lightly.
It literally, like, ugh, it makes me like sick when I even think about it. Like the word cannibalism, ugh, ick.
I know.
Ick.
I know. I can't. He says that besides Gil, there had been three alleged co-conspirators in this situation.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was Michael Van Nuys. Another guy was a Pakistan man, also known as Ali Khan. And then a man in England known as Moody Blues. In the chats that they look at, Gil talks about having a place up in the mountains, having a pulley system to string women up and slow roast and torture them set up in his basement. And that he has a giant oven ready to stuff them into.
Oh my God.
Ugh. Yeah. These are all like things he says.
Yeah.
So we get to meet Juror X. Now she is in like a blacked out screen.
Right.
She doesn't want to be seen. And
hell,
I don't,
no.
I don't blame her.
I would not either.
No. She says that they all had copies of the chats. They had to determine how much of it seemed to be true. She said, you could tell this guy had a problem. He was sick. Quite fucking sick.
It's quite evident early on
in the chats
that what he was saying wasn't just like your normal fetish type of talk. I mean, this gets really, really demented and horror movie-like. I mean, it's things that just don't seem like realistic things and that are really far-fetched and, again, scary. I mean, it's horrific.
Yeah. I mean, there's a such thing as like S&M where, you know, people like to be kind of tortured and and it's a sexual gratification for them. I get that part of it.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of that. Yeah.
And this, it kept bringing me back to like Ed Kemper, who like would fuck the decapitated heads of some of the people that he murdered. And I'm just like,
or Jeffrey Dahmer.
Oh, like, right.
You know what I
who
mean?
Like, have sex with the dead bodies.
Yeah.
Like, it's that kind of a thing where I'm like, that crosses a line.
Well, and like the cutting up of bodies,
yes,
and dismemberment. I mean, and the eating, you know what I mean? Like that really takes me back to Jeffrey Dahmer and like, ugh.
Yes.
Ugh. It is. And I can tell this juror, it was tough for them.
Like
this was not an easy decision for them when we get to the end of the trial, but it's really fucked up.
It is.
It's really, really fucked up.
It is. And she said the problem was, is that they couldn't convict him on his sick mind. Right?
Right.
Because if he didn't do anything, there's nothing to convict.
Right.
So she says they were there to convict on a conspiracy to kidnap, kill, maim, and rape. They're showing some pictures of some of the women that he knew. He had taken real pictures of real people in his life and posted them to some of these sites.
Oh.
Which seems to take it past fantasy.
It does. It now you are exposing people you know to people you don't really know.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, oh, that is the type of shit that's super scary because anyone on the web, not even the dark web or any of like this kind of stuff, they can take any of your photos.
Yep.
Anyone can save a photo that you post online.
Yep.
That is terrifying.
It is.
You know what I mean? Like just thinking about that. But when it comes to this, when you know that these people are fucking sick and have really deranged thoughts, that you're putting people at potential risk. Even if you're not going to do anything, these people could potentially do something and find these people.
And the scary part is that there's a market for that kind of shit out there.
I know.
That's the scary part. She goes to say that he even had a blueprint. For example, he had something written out that said abducting and cooking Kimberly, a blueprint. And it was literally like a list of things that he would need, complete with pictures. And all of the materials that he listed were pretty easily obtained.
Oh, for sure. I mean, it's your standard, like, kidnapping / rape type of kit. You got rope, duct tape, chloroform, tarp, like, things that you would need to hide a body.
Yeah, I know. Dara Gregorian comes back and says that one of the major figures in this investigation was Alicia Friska, because investigators had claimed that Gil had been stalking her through messages about following her out of school and watching her and whatnot.
Right, right.
On these chats, like, ew.
Oh.
Ooh. And this, again, this is somebody he knows personally, you guys. That's what's fucking creepy.
And again, he's a police officer. He can be in his patrol car following her. And she probably wouldn't have thought twice about it. You know what I mean?
Right.
Cops drive slow. They're checking things out. Like, that wouldn't seem weird.
Nope.
You know? And he knows where all these people live. I mean, that is the most terrifying thing.
That I don't like.
They know.
Yeah.
He knew where all of them physically lived and their addresses. That is scary.
Well, and it takes a whole nother turn when Gil starts talking money with Michael Van Nuys online. So Robert Kolker goes on to say that there's a shift, and it's chilling, when there's a statement, quote, $5,000, and you need to make sure she's not found. She will definitely make the news. Like, this is what Gil says to Van Nuys online.
Right.
I mean, I don't know about you, but that sounds fucking real to me.
Absolutely.
Yeah. When you're talking money, I'm sorry, that just seems so much more realistic.
Absolutely, because he tried to negotiate down to $4,000.
Yeah.
And then Gil came back and said, no, $5,000.
Yep.
Because you need to make sure she can't be found and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
I'm like, that is real to me.
Yeah, that's totally real
to me. That is a conspiracy. You are conspiring with someone to transfer money in order to exchange for this woman.
Yeah. It's creepy.
It literally gives me goosebumps. It scares me.
So we meet James Cohen. He's a Fordham law school professor. He says that, yeah, fantasies are scary, and the level of detail was even scarier that he goes into. But again, we all have to remember nothing ever happened.
Right.
He even goes on to say that there were many missed dates. All right. So there would be something in the messages between them where they would say, yeah, I'll call you on Tuesday. And then there's nothing. And there's nothing for several Tuesdays.
Yep.
So basically, he's chalking this up to these are fantasies. Okay. Derek Gregorian goes on to say that, yeah, there was never an oven. He never had a pulley system in the basement, especially because he lived in an apartment building. So the basement was a laundry room. Like, so he is literally kind of almost like, I don't know, glorifying himself for these people, making it seem like he's somebody who he's not.
Right.
And I mean, I kind of get that. Aaron Murphy from the New York School of Law says that if this was being done on Craigslist, you would have known immediately that it was a scam.
Right.
He didn't have any of the supplies on his blueprints, and he made up false information left and right. Gil says the chats make him look like a monster. No shit.
Yes, they do.
He says that the grotesque language and the unconventional thoughts were there, but there's no evidence. And I'm like,
but again, one can speculate that.
One can speculate.
That is a conspiracy. Even though it didn't happen yet, if it would have kept on, it probably would have happened.
Right.
And that, again, we're stuck in this gray area of like
prediction.
Yeah. Like, okay, do we let him go free with the possibility that this is actually going to happen in the future and subject someone to being murdered, right? Yep. And kidnapped? Or do we convict him because we think he's deranged enough to do it if we let him out?
Right.
Right? I mean, it's such a fine line, and it's hard.
It is hard. So then we hear a reporter stating that there is shock in the courtroom because there has been a guilty to commit kidnapping and wrongfully accessing a federal database reached by the jury.
I was kind of shocked by that.
I was too.
I didn't think that they would reach that conclusion. I thought it was actually going to be a hung jury.
I did too.
I thought that there was going to be a few people that were like, again, there's no crime. There's no victim.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And they all found him unanimously guilty.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Crazy.
His mom comes back and says that she almost froze in time. I mean, it was so heartbreaking for her. I mean, she knew he wasn't a cannibal and never ate anyone and knew he wasn't a kidnapper and knew he wasn't a murderer. He didn't actually commit a crime. So again, it sent shockwaves, you know, through his family because he didn't actually commit a crime. So they never really thought he would get convicted.
I mean, I'm kind of with her. I probably would have thought the same thing.
Oh, for sure. And of course, she is bombarded by the media directly after the verdict. It's like, can you fucking leave people alone after something like this? Like, this is traumatizing. They don't want to talk to you. She's extremely upset, you can tell. She's trying to run to her vehicle, basically, to leave because she wants to be alone with her feelings right now. You know what I mean?
Yep.
With this and deal with it in her own way and mourn, really, the loss of her son, because her son at this point might spend the rest of his life in prison.
Right.
Gil says that he went back to the prison and completely broke down. Yeah. I mean, he didn't want to do it in front of people, of course. I don't think anyone really wants to do that. But he also couldn't believe it. It is kind of crazy that they came to that conclusion their first go around.
Yeah.
It might have been a long time for them to get to that point, but they all found him guilty.
Yeah.
Now, Julia Gatto, his defense attorney, tells us that the case involved unusual, ugly thoughts, and she thinks the jury just couldn't get past that. Of course.
Yeah.
It all came down to those chats he had with those people. That was it.
Yep.
Do we let him go free and the possibility of this happening or put him away?
Right.
Because we think that he could do something.
Yeah.
She goes on to say that it was devastating for everyone. I mean, when you lose, you lost it for this human being.
Yeah.
I mean, everything was taken away from him in that simple sentence of being guilty, right? His liberty, his rights, all of that. And I think it was because they didn't want that what if moment to happen.
Yeah.
What if they let him go free? What if, you know? But again, if there's reasonable doubt, you should not convict someone.
I know.
You know what I mean? That it all kind of comes back to that, because I think there was reasonable doubt there that he wouldn't commit this crime in real life. There was a lot of different instances that popped up. But again, you can't know how you would do it unless you were sitting in their chair, right?
Right.
We hear from defense attorney Robert Baum, and he says that people can be prosecuted and convicted for their thoughts, and that's even sadder to think about. It really is. I mean, this proves it.
Yeah, it's scary.
We get some on-screen text that says, Valley's defense motions for the judge to overturn the verdict, arguing the evidence was insufficient. Valley faces life in prison. We pan over to the Metropolitan Correctional Center. Another set of on-screen text comes up. Valley has spent 7 months in solitary confinement for his own protection.
Well, yeah, he's a cop in prison.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I heard they do not do well.
No.
No.
No, not at all. We hear a call. We're not sure who it's from or who it's to. We obviously hear Gil talking, and he says he's depressed. You know, he's waiting on what the judge will say, but his defense says it doesn't look good.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah. It's hard to overturn a guilty verdict when it comes to our justice system.
Yeah.
We meet Lee Rowland, who's part of the American Civil Liberties Union, and she says that this case raises a really big question. What is the line between thought and action?
Yeah.
Again, it's so gray. Daniel Engberg comes back and says the prosecution was saying his Google searches were overt acts in furthering the conspiracy. Research on how to kidnap, searching knives, chloroform, etc. It all came back to that Google search.
Yeah.
But it's dangerous to assume a Google search is an overt act. I mean, seriously, if anyone looked at my Google search history, I mean, yikes, especially doing this podcast now.
Yeah.
I Google so much stuff from these cases. Like, what is chloroform? How can you get chloroform? You know, like things like that. And it's because I'm trying to do a little bit of research so I know more. But it's like, again, yeah, that is dangerous to assume that a Google search is an overt act. Sometimes it's literally just your mind being curious about something.
Totally.
Wanting an answer. It's so easy. Anytime I need an answer for anything, I go to Google.
Yeah.
Even if I don't really know what the question is, I just start typing in the words.
Because someone else has asked it.
Someone knows, you know, and it pops up somewhere. So I agree with him when he states that, because a lot of people would be convicted of something if it came down to their Google search history.
Agreed.
Robert Kolker tells us that when you think of thought crime, you think of George Orwell in 1984. And it's easier to understand what goes on in people's minds nowadays simply because of the technology that we have. Social media, Google, the internet, right? People have the ability to put things out there way more than they ever have ever.
Oh, yeah.
People kept their thoughts to themselves. They didn't communicate with people. They didn't have this never-ending box of what we call the internet
mm-hmm.
to put every single thought out there.
And a never-ending audience to witness it.
Exactly.
You see posts, you see rants, you'll see, you know, live videos.
Right.
I mean, all of that stuff. I have been guilty of going on my Snapchat occasionally and ranting to whoever my followers are about whatever just pissed me off.
Yeah.
Because sometimes I need an audience to hear me.
That's right.
Because me saying it to myself is not enough.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah. Now we meet Lori Penny from The Guardian. Now she says, you know, it's possible for the internet to know more than your best friend or even your family knows about you.
It's true.
And Google searches can be very private. I mean,
yes,
that's the first place I go.
Always, for everything. I mean, I don't think I've ever told anyone what I search in Google. You know, it's just not something you tell
people. No,
some
of it is embarrassing. Okay, like this
summer.
How to
spell things or, I mean, things that are
so
easy.
Not even that. I was thinking like one time I Googled like, what does scalp disorders look like? Because I had something that itched on my scalp. And
right.
I'm like, okay, I'm a cosmetologist. We
You're
learned
right.
about different disorders, but like, could this be from like, what is this? You know,
for sure.
What does it look like? And I'm asking my daughter, what does this look like? Describe it to me. You know, so
I do this
little
same
things like
thing.
That.
Yes.
Right?
Yep.
Even with this new pregnancy, early on, I was having some spotting,
yeah.
which I didn't have with my daughter the first time. So I'm Googling how much blood is too much blood when you're
right.
spotting.
Right.
You know, what does a miscarriage look like?
Yeah.
Which all just looks, I mean, it's creepy.
And it can always be interpreted in a different way if someone were to yes. look at it. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Because they don't really know the backstory. So, yeah.
Hey, guys. This is Ben.
And I'm Karen.
All you do is read about crime.
If you have serial killer posters in your bedroom.
If you're hiding newspaper article clippings under your bed. Looking at you, Karen.
Don't be concerned. We share your compulsion.
Join us, Ben and Karen, husband and wife team, as we delve deeper into the mind of serial killers.
Dive into the darker side of humanity, but from the safety of your own couch. You can find our website.
CrimeandCompulsion.com.
Find us on Facebook.
Crime and Compulsion.
Find us on Instagram.
Crime and Compulsion Podcast.
Find us on Twitter.
At Crime Compulsion. Find our episodes wherever you get your favorite podcast streaming from.
Daniel Engberg comes back and he says that Gil's wife is searching things like, my husband doesn't love me,
mm-hmm.
looking for other people who have maybe looked into this as well. He says that Google could actually show that some of our searches could be extensions of our own thoughts, right?
Absolutely. That is what it is.
Yeah.
It is our thoughts wanting answers.
Yep.
You know
and
what I mean?
And a lot of it is like predicted.
Yeah.
Because think about, like you just said, you start typing in a question, it's going to give you like 10 options that pop up. Like, is
For sure.
this what you're trying to ask?
Yep.
Wait a minute. No, but now I'm curious. I've done that before where I'm like, wait, someone looked into that?
Yeah.
Now I'm curious what that looks like.
Yep.
Robert Kolker says that the Google searches from Gil can be as open to interpretation as the chats themselves.
Mm-hmm.
The defense saw this as storytelling, a communitarian storytelling exercise between him and other people of interest.
Yep.
The prosecution argues that the chats are a window into the writer's thoughts, which when he said that,
mm-hmm.
I was like, oh, fuck, because I have had many ideas of novels I want to write. None of them are ones that maybe I'd want, you know, my best friend to read necessarily. In fact, a lot of them I've thought about writing under a different name because,
really?
Yes, because there are things that I think about that actually scare the shit out of me that I want to investigate because it scares the shit out of
me. For sure. And people do that a lot with novels.
Right. And so a lot of it is almost like my nightmares, but come to life.
Sure.
Because it's interesting enough that it scares me that it's got to scare somebody else. And you know that we all like to be scared a little bit, right?
Of course. Of course.
So that goes to think about things like, are novels then a window into the author's thoughts? I mean, look at Stephen King.
For sure.
Never been, you know, arrested and charged. But his stuff scares the living shit out of most people.
Yes, it does. So that's the whole thing. Why wouldn't he be then convicted of his thoughts,
right?
Where does that line end? Because he's very deranged in his thoughts, too.
Absolutely. And I would almost go so far to say is that he's almost the inventor of the fear surrounding clowns, right?
Yes.
I mean, seriously.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. We meet Maria Tater. Now, she's a professor of folklore and mythology at Harvard, and she says that there's a fascination about stories about violence. And I mean, I think, again, we can all agree that's fucking true. Look at what we're listening to and talking about right now, right? Mm-hmm. There's a fascination about it because it's so outside of what we consider normal behavior. She says that it's always been fairly easy to draw the line between fantasy and reality, but in the postmodern era, it's more difficult to draw those boundaries because now we have things such as Google histories that could now look like planning when really it could just be a curiosity needing to be fixed.
Exactly.
Now, Gary Allen, he's an author of How to Serve Men, says a lot of it goes back to our basic primal feelings. We have a propensity for violence. In theory, you can act them out in stories, but not in real life.
Right.
All right. So again, as parents, how many times has your kid pissed you off to the point where you literally fantasize about opening the door and just pitching them out a moving vehicle, right? Are you ever going to actually do that? God, I hope not.
Right.
Please don't. But we all think about it. And for a second, it feels good, right?
It's true. And I think there's thoughts that come into our mind that we just can't help.
Oh, yes.
Happens, you know?
Yep.
And so
road rage.
Yes.
That's when it comes into me.
For sure. Me too. And again, it's just if we go down this road of starting to convict people of their thoughts, it's going to be dangerous. Yeah. A lot of us are going to be in prison.
Yep.
I mean, it's something that a lot of us cannot control. It just happens.
Yeah.
Now, in his scenario, it definitely went farther than what we would ever think of doing, right?
Right.
A lot of this is
mine are mental way more. Face punches.
Right, right, right. And his obviously went into way more detail and it is very scary. But still, it kind of sets a premise, right? If we're going to convict this person, why wouldn't we convict X, Y, and Z too for their thoughts that are very similar?
Right. And where's the line?
Exactly.
Is it because they only talk about kidnapping that they shouldn't be? Is it because he talked about cannibalism?
Right.
You know, like, where is that line?
Right.
Aaron Murphy comes back on and says that it's really daunting to think about, you know, us tapping into our true, possible, authentic selves on the internet. She said she thinks it's more likely that the internet invites us to both who we are and who we are not.
Mm-hmm.
And I completely agree with that.
Especially going back to Google. You type two words in, you have 50 things coming up of things that you can search.
Yep.
And it has nothing to do with what you were actually going to search. But then your curiosity is piqued. So now I'm going to start this rabbit hole dig into something I never even wanted to do. That's why people get into these big, huge rabbit holes of things and can't get themselves out because they're so curious to know more.
Absolutely.
Right? It's just a human nature type of action that we're doing.
Because we're trying to make sense of something that doesn't make sense.
Everyone's trying to make sense of this world we live in, right? Yeah. Like, why are we here? What is the purpose for the things that we do, right?
Yeah.
And when it comes to this, why are we intrigued by violence and crime? And why do some people commit these heinous crimes and some people don't? Where is that switch in the human brain that tells you, hey, I'm not going to do this kind of thing. I'm going to be a good human being. And what brings you to the other side?
Right.
Right. There's so many things that you can, you know, talk about back and forth when it comes to this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Because it's hard to understand. You can't really understand it.
No, you can't. And you won't know until you're that person in that position.
Exactly.
Right. Are you going to be the one that lays it down or are you going to be the one that pulls the trigger?
Exactly.
Right. Aaron goes on to say that, you know, the biggest fear is the open trading of fantasy becoming a policed zone. And that we could find ourselves in a very different society than many of us thought that we signed up for,
mm-hmm.
which I totally agree. I don't want somebody policing my thoughts.
No.
God, most people don't want to be in my head. All right? They just don't. Things come in there. It's scary. It's a scary place. I try to keep it to myself, but sometimes they come out on these podcasts.
For sure.
Now, Lori Penny comes back on and she says that we should be allowed to write a dirty story on the internet or have a dirty fantasy. It stops being fine, though, when other real people are involved. And that's where I totally agree.
And especially unknowingly. Right. Right? I mean, none of these women knew about this until his wife found out about it.
Exactly.
You know, and I think it would have probably stayed a secret until something would have happened.
Oh, totally.
Or until, you know, like he states later on, it all stopped, right? He wanted to stop it. I don't believe that.
I don't believe it either.
But still, none of these people knew.
Right. And she goes on to say that using police databases and his position in law enforcement to track down these women is beyond. And it's an extraordinary breach of trust between the police and the public.
For sure.
We shouldn't have to worry about that happening. No. Right. She says that it wasn't just a thought crime. The idea that everything that happened on the internet is fantasy and not real can be very dangerous.
Oh, for sure. And she also states that the darkness comes from us, not the internet.
Yeah.
And people also, I think, get that twisted a little bit where they blame it all on the internet. But how did the internet come about? People.
Yeah.
All of this stemmed from people. People created the content that's on the internet. So it's true. You can't mix the two up.
Kind of goes with the whole like gun control. It's not guns that kill people. It's the person pulling the trigger.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now we see some on-screen text that states after 21 months in jail, Valley will hear Judge Paul Gardeffi's ruling on the motion for acquittal. Motions for acquittal are almost never granted, as we know.
Yeah.
Once you're guilty by a court of law, it is extremely hard
to overturn it.
You can go appeal. Almost every time it's denied.
Yep.
So we see Liz, his mom, getting ready to go to the courthouse, hear the ruling. She's very nervous. She's praying for good news. She even shows us that she kept his cop uniform, which I found a little strange.
She even makes mention of it being weird that she did.
So maybe she doesn't go in that room very often. I don't know. But that would be something I would want to toss away because of all the bad juju that's with that. Right. You know what I mean? Like, that's probably something you shouldn't be keeping. Now, she knew it was going to be a news media frenzy, obviously. But she wasn't going to talk to anyone. She didn't want to have to communicate with them, and good for her.
Yeah.
Now, his dad, Gil Sr., tells us that he wants to see his son not be a felon. He didn't commit any crimes, right? And it's interesting that he said that because I thought he would say, I don't want to see my son in prison.
Yep.
But he said, I don't want to see my son as a felon. So he was more looking at his record versus him actually being out of prison. So it kind of shows us that side of his dad that he was telling us about, that strict, stay in line, kick you in the butt kind of dad.
Well, and if you're in prison, you're in prison, right? That is your life.
Right.
But if you're a felon, that's on your record.
Forever.
Right.
Right.
And everybody will see that. Employers, everybody who, you know. So,
right.
I mean, I kind of get that. Yeah. He's already going to be hindered in life because of this.
Yep.
But I feel like that would further.
For sure.
It's like adding insult to injury, right?
Absolutely. Now, Gil walks out of the courtroom and makes a statement to the press. And he states that, I want to take this opportunity to apologize to everyone who has been hurt, shocked, and offended by my infantile actions. I also want to thank my family. From day one, their support never wavered. I've needed that more than anyone will ever know during this impossible situation. I want to go home and spend some time with my family. Thank you very much. And that was kind of it.
Blah, blah, blah. I also really was like bothered by the fact that he used the word infantile.
I know.
When talking about his actions, because I'm sorry, I don't know a single child or infant that would have thought these things and done and said these things. That was like, fuck you. No.
I think he's just trying to
make it seem like an immature situation.
Yep, yep. And make his actions seem okay,
yep.
I guess, or try to rationalize his situation, right?
Yeah.
That this isn't that bad. You know, you just weren't looking at it in the correct way, or you know what I mean?
Yeah,
I didn't like that either. Now, James Cohen comes in and he's a law professor and he tells us that an acquittal on insufficient evidence is extremely rare, like we just talked about.
Yeah.
An acquittal means not guilty. It doesn't mean innocent.
I like that.
I did too. And it actually made me think. I've never really thought of it that way.
Mm-hmm.
But it's true. James goes on to say that, how would you feel if you let him off and he goes out and eats somebody? And I'm like, oh my God. And they immediately pan to a pot of spaghetti. I'm like, why? Why do you have to go from someone talking about eating a human right to food? They do this a lot.
They do this a lot. Ugh. I even wrote down at one point, I'm like, why do they keep making us watch him eat? I mean,
I can't.
For anybody who has a problem with that or a weak stomach, I probably just wouldn't even watch this. And it's not like he's eating gross food.
No, they're doing it on purpose.
But they're doing it on purpose. They're emphasizing the fact that he's eating almost all the time. Yeah. And at one point, I'm like, we're literally just watching this man get fatter on this documentary, and I can't handle it.
It's so true. Like, why? Why? They're all making breakfast. They're making wraps.
He's always the one making it, too.
Yes.
And oh, he's the chef.
Of course. It's, you know, back to the cannibalism thing. Yep. He's make, I don't know. It's, I thought it was a little overdone.
Oh, for sure.
They could have, you know, taken out a few of the eating scenes that they had.
Yeah.
Gilbert.
It was a bit infantile.
Yeah. Now, since Gil's been out, he's actually on house arrest.
Yep.
So he's not really out. He is stationed at his mom's house at this point. He can't leave.
Yeah, he's got an ankle monitor.
Yep, yep. And he makes this joke because he has like a fork in his hand. And he's like, no one's alarmed that I have a fork in my hand and there's people around, right? Like, everyone good? And I'm like,
too soon.
A little too soon for that.
Too soon.
Yeah. No one was laughing. Not a single person laughed. His mom didn't even laugh. She's like, she kind of like went with the joke.
Yep.
But didn't laugh at it.
No.
None
because
of the crew
too
laughed.
Soon.
Like, dude, you just got out of you just got out of prison and you're still going through all this stuff. Don't do that.
Right.
Little distasteful here. Now we see a New York Post tabloid. And they're always way to the extreme.
Oh, yeah.
And on the front cover, it says Bon Appetit, like bone, like
right.
A human bone.
Yeah.
And it says Mom cooks dinner for freed cannibal cop. And it's a huge image of him walking out of the courtroom with his mom.
Yeah.
Gil goes on to say that this used to be a skeleton in his closet, and now it's out in the wide open. Like, obviously, it's embarrassing for him.
Yeah.
And he's never going to get over this. I mean,
no.
Every time he meets someone, if he meets a woman, if he meets whoever, he has to tell them about this.
Yeah.
It's going to come out at some point. And how do you do that? Like, that's really, really hard if you think about that.
Yeah.
Now, he doesn't recall how it all started, but he became good at this so-called role playing, right?
Yep.
And he doesn't think his job had much to do with it. Like, they were kind of insinuating, right? That it was stressful and all that kind of stuff. And then they're showing us these in the background while he's talking, like intermittently, they're showing us these really creepy photos. Did you happen to notice how they were almost like negatives? They kind of look like a negative of a photo.
Yeah.
And it was like scratchy and like going in and out of color. And it freaked me out.
Well, yeah, they got to make it.
And it's like women, like,
yeah.
Like naked women. You can't see anything, but like
some of them tied up.
They're like their mouths are open. Some of them look dead. I mean, it's creepy stuff.
Super creepy. We meet Violet Blue. She's an author of fetish sex. She says that, you know, it can be really hard to understand why someone would be interested in something like that. You know, some things provoke arousal when we are somewhat unaware of it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if you think about it, have you ever been in a situation or maybe watching something and all of a sudden you're kind of like, ooh, why am I kind of like turned on right now by that?
Right.
And I think a lot of us can even kind of go along with when we see like maybe like bad boys, right?
Yeah.
So like with the Aaron Hernandez, I was like, oh my God, why am I like turned on by his high school photos? And I'm like, oh, yuck, does this make me a cougar or like, you know, something worse?
Right.
No, it's just there was something about that whole scenario that just spoke to me in a primal way, right? It's very primal. We meet Chris Kraft, the director of clinical services at Hopkins University. And he says that, you know, many people will ask if abuse or trauma was something that triggered this in Gil. You know, there's lots of room for interpretation, but we don't get to choose what we're aroused by.
Right.
And I think a lot of people forget that.
It's so true.
It's things that come on, right? That's why handcuffs might turn you on where chocolates and champagne may turn me on, right?
Exactly.
Some women are turned on by a man who can work on a car. Others are turned on by the man who does the dishes, right?
Right.
So, you know, there's those types of things. We don't get to choose it. Those are just things that turn us on.
Yeah, that we're attracted to.
Yeah. And I think, you know, for the most part, a lot of that is kind of normal, right? Or what we've considered normal.
For the most part, yes. Yep.
So we meet Dr. David Greenfield, and he works for the Center for Internet and Technology Addiction. And he says that we live in a pretty puritanical society, which I totally agree with him on that. He says that overtly, sex is very open, right? We use it in television, movies, advertising, music.
It's all over and we don't even think about it.
No, I mean, think about some of the songs that are coming out, right? Cardi B had this big one that came out, WAP.
Which I actually really enjoy.
Do you? I literally had heard it for the first time on TikTok and I was like, yep, does nothing for me. So right there.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I don't know what it is. It's like, I never want my daughter to hear it, but I really enjoy it.
Well,
and I'm like, why?
Yeah. But think about some of the Baby Got Back.
Right.
Right? Super sexual.
Yeah.
The whole thing. I remember being in sixth grade talking about how my anaconda don't want none unless you got buns, hun.
Yep.
Right? Like, what the fuck? Right? So it's very overt when it's out and open in the public. However, covertly, people are really uncomfortable with things.
People don't like to talk about it.
No, it's I think a lot of people are very uncomfortable with their own sexuality.
And maybe a little embarrassed, too.
You for know? Sure, like, because they don't want to be looked at as a weirdo.
Yes, it's uncomfortable, embarrassing. There's kind of all of this fear, I think, that comes with it. Because you just don't know how someone's going to act when you tell them, like, oh, I like to do this.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, that's weird.
Ew.
Like that, yeah, you're a weirdo.
Yeah.
So people don't even talk about it.
Even normal things like feet, right?
Mm-hmm.
Some people super turned on by feet.
It's a huge market.
It's a huge market.
Yeah.
Other people literally could make them throw up,
right?
It's such a juxtaposition of things that we are exposed to on a daily basis. And Dr. Greenfield says that this give and take of the overt expression and the covert inhibitions that we have may lead to sexual pathology, sexual problems, and sexually compulsive behaviors.
Yeah.
Now, Violet Blue comes back and she says that from what we know, he kind of grew up in an environment where sex wasn't talked about. And at this point in the documentary, they're showing a lot of Catholic school footage.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it.
A lot of it.
And just knowing what I know, based on my husband who grew up in Catholic school in a very strict Catholic family, I totally understand this. She says that, you know, anything falling outside of acceptable would be considered horrible, shameful. Mm-hmm. I mean, literally, you're going to go to hell for having these thoughts.
For sure.
So I think in this situation, it was almost demonized so much that he kind of got pushed over the edge. Does that make sense?
It totally does.
Where I feel like in families where you talk about it more openly, it's just a little bit more normalized. And maybe I'm totally making a generalization about
it. I would have to agree. Again, I don't think there's any real statistics around it because, again, it's something that you can't really understand.
You'd have to take a lot of like polls from people.
For sure. But I can only imagine that if you are more open and honest with your kids as they're growing up, and don't force things down their throat.
Yep.
They then get to experience themselves with what they like and be honest with you, open and honest with you about the thoughts that they're having, right?
Yeah.
So maybe you can like catch on to some of these things a little bit earlier. But again, it's hard to tell.
When I think of it's things too that are being kind of toted to you as being horrible and gross and shameful and bad, I think almost then makes you not want to talk about it.
Right.
So in this case, he goes online and he finds other people who are thinking the same way he is because he doesn't want to tell his wife. He doesn't want to tell his family.
No, not at all.
These things. And a lot of times, most people don't talk to their family about sex.
Right.
Most people are not me who talks to everybody about it. Right. So I think it's a very different situation.
For sure.
Now, his mom thinks that some of it may have had to do with the divorce. She says that his dad was very obsessive, controlling, verbally abusive, and that she kind of laughs in the documentary saying, you know, I don't think he's going to want to talk about why we divorced. And he doesn't. He says, I'm not going to talk about that. Honestly, I feel like a lot of parents think that divorce has a huge effect on every area of their children. I don't know. Maybe it does. But I don't see how the correlation is in here.
Right. Yeah, it's hard to tell. But again, it's hard to understand the human mind because I think these types of things affect people differently.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like these kind of like quote unquote traumas, I guess, of a divorce, right? can affect people differently. Yeah. So it can make them do different things. It can make them want to be a better person, right? And rise up. It can make them completely fall to the ground. And
some are unfazed.
Right, exactly. So yeah. I think it comes down to the person. It's very individualized when we look at it that way.
Yeah. And I think as parents, we like to think that we fuck up our children every time we turn around.
Of course.
So I think she's almost trying to like solve the problem.
Right.
With an answer.
Yep.
It kind of had to do with this.
And blame herself a little bit for why this occurred.
Right. Now, Gil goes on to say that, he had never talked about it before and had felt comfortable to do it online, kind of like what I just mentioned. He said, he'd be back to normal once the computer was off and it would be his normal daily life, wife, husband, kid, cop, when the lights came on. He says that, he is completely incapable of any violence. He says he couldn't hurt a fly. Okay. But also, I was like, you were a cop. So I feel like in a way you could have and should have had the ability to hurt somebody in a situation where you needed to.
Right.
I just didn't really quite like that comment.
I think people just say that as like a scapegoat kind of comment.
I felt like it was so, generic.
Yeah. You don't want to make people believe that you could be a harmful person.
Right.
But it's like these chats beg to differ.
They do.
You think about a lot of creepy and scary things.
Yeah.
So I think it's just his way of hoping that all of us viewers will be on his side.
Right. Well, and Daniel Coker comes back and says, even if he is innocent of planning a kidnapping, right? He didn't actually plan it and like follow through. He's admitted an interest in kidnapping.
Right.
It's all over court documents. He's on record stating that he can't get it out of his mind. That's scary. That's the part
terrifying.
Where it's like, okay, is this a precursor?
Because if you think about it all the time and it's something that possibly turns you on, there's going to be a point where you need more.
Yep.
And what does that mean? If you can't stop thinking about kidnapping, what is the next step? To actually kidnap someone, because
right.
that's going to raise your libido and get you off a little bit more, right? Like,
yep.
That is the problem with some of these things. When you get into that like sadistic aspect of sexuality, if it involves hurting other people, there comes a point where you can't satisfy that need anymore and that you have to do more.
Yep.
And that's when crimes occur. That's when problems happen. So yes, that is scary. And to me, that had me wavering again.
I know. That's the part where I was like, shit, now I don't know what to think, right?
That's scary.
So there was a forensic psychiatrist that actually had kind of interviewed Gil, and he had interviewed like many other really well-known quote-unquote psychopaths.
Right.
Like John Hinckley Jr., Joel Rifkin, and Andrea Yates. And he went on to say that, in my opinion, there is no reliable evidence to suggest that his erotic conversations could reasonably be construed as conspiratorial plans rather than conversations that were an end in themselves.
Right.
Basically kind of saying like, he's as safe as you and me. Like, these are just conversations.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that's kind of a big deal to be said. But when it came down to it, he was never brought on the stand to say that out loud.
Right. We meet Michael Wellner. He's a forensic psychiatrist. And he says that if Dr. Dietz had testified that deviant sexual fantasy doesn't relate to those who sadistically rape or murder, he would have been slaughtered on cross-examination.
Oh, big time.
Because it does correlate. Like, there have been a lot of cases that have went to trial that there was a correlation.
Absolutely.
So you can't use that and testify to that because it's not always true. His defense has stated it was a coping mechanism for him.
Yeah.
And I was thinking that it might actually be more psychologically harmful and cause habitual behavior.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, again, he's not feeding the full need of what he wants. It's going to start to become a ritual. He's going to continually do it daily, all the time. We see he's always on this damn computer when he's home.
And he's normalizing it with these other people.
Right.
So it's becoming not so taboo.
Correct. Michael goes on to say that the most fascinating aspect of this case is that Gil's sexuality was hidden. Like, when you have to hide a part of yourself from your partner, it never ends well. He never told his wife about his fantasies, what he was thinking about, what he actually enjoyed, nope. Right? And we see a court testimony from Gil's wife, Kathleen, that states he always said that because he got home late, he couldn't go right to sleep. So he would play video games, watch TV, go on the internet for a couple of hours. Then after I got pregnant, it kept getting worse. He would stay up until 3, 4, 5 in the morning or just not come to sleep in our bed. And then all this really weird stuff started happening.
Yeah.
Then she goes and gets spyware installed on the computer and found everything.
I kind of want to know what led her to the spyware.
I think she thought he was cheating.
Yeah, that's probably a good one.
I immediately was like, as a woman,
yeah,
whose husband isn't even coming to bed with you anymore and yeah, is staying up all hours of the night, I'm immediately thinking cheating.
Yeah. So, yeah, she was probably just trying to catch him.
Yep. That would be the first thing in my mind. And then when she found out what was really happening, holy shit. Could you imagine that twist in your mind? Like, holy fuck.
Uh-huh.
This is way more horrifying than I thought.
Like, yeah.
Like, I'm living in this house.
Can we go back to when he was cheating on me?
Seriously. Back to the court testimony from Kathleen. And I quote, "It logged every keystroke that is made on the computer and every website that is visited and takes pictures every 5 minutes or so of whatever's happening on the computer screen. There were all of these websites that I'd never seen. Dark Fetish Net, Sexy Amazons, Dark Fet, Motherless, Fet Life. I mean, I know S&M is kind of popular, like 50 Shades of Grey, you know, but this seemed different."
Yeah. I've never seen or read 50 Shades
of
Grey.
Oh my God. When that first came out, I could not put the book down.
Really?
I read all of the books like right as they came out. So like the first one had come out and then I had to wait for the second one.
Yeah.
Wait for the third one because they hadn't been published yet.
Right.
So, oh my God, that was a craze and I was obsessed with it. And then when the movie came out, my husband loves the movies.
Really?
We own all the movies. Yeah. We really enjoyed it. I mean, the acting...
I've heard the acting isn't the greatest.
Isn't great. But yeah, again, I mean, they're not A-list actors.
Right.
And
it's look at Twilight. I mean,
the acting is probably uncomfortable, though, trying to act this stuff out.
Right.
Imagine all the people that are in that room filming this. I mean, it's almost like soft porn a little
right.
bit. And when you're just an actor and you're not like a pornography actor, it's probably pretty uncomfortable for
yeah.
you. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I refused to read or watch any of it because it was too big. I'm one of those where I'm like, nope, I'm going to wait until it's done and over with, and then I'll do it.
Definitely get into it. You'll like it.
I wonder.
It's really detailed. It's awesome.
Okay.
Really awesome. Now back to Kathleen's court testimony. She goes on to state that the girl on the front page was dead. I noticed on one of the screen pictures that was taken an email address that I didn't know about. So I went to Yahoo Mail and entered the password that Gil had told me to use for everything. All of a sudden, I was staring at pictures of my friends, pictures of people we knew. There were thousands.
That was fucking crazy. Also, can we talk about the fact that he used a password that he had told her? I was like, I don't know. Did he really kind of want to get caught?
I have no clue.
Or he's just a man and can't think of that many different things. And, you know, I don't know. I was like, wow.
I found that interesting, too.
Yeah.
So she confronted him the next morning and then ended up leaving with their baby.
Yeah.
And left him.
I would have, too.
Of course. His wife ended up texting him and asked him if he had ever put her or their baby on that site. And he said, absolutely not. But we found out that that was a lie.
Yep.
He didn't put her last name, but he stated everything about her, the details of her height, her weight, the way she looked, her body type, all that kind of stuff, and stated that she had a daughter.
And had that posted in the 4th of July menu was the title of that page.
Yep. And then stated that he wanted Kathleen to be tied up by her feet, her throat slit, and watch the blood gush out of her. And that suffering is his enjoyment. So the longer that they can suffer, the more enjoyment for him.
Yeah. And in the chats, he goes on to mention to whoever he's talking with, about Kathleen that she has a lot of meat on her ass, thighs, and calves.
Oh, God, because they're thinking about eating her, you guys.
And as a woman, I'm like, that bastard, she just had a baby. Fuck you. Instantly, I'm like, she ain't fat. Like, I was just like, these pregnancy hormones, you guys, I can't. I was offended by that. And then I'm like, oh, wait, that's right.
That's right. That's
looking
right
at her like dinner.
Yeah. No. Oh, gross.
I know. Gross. Ugh. We then see some on-screen text that says, according to the FBI, Valley accessed Dark Fetish Net over 1,000 times in 2012. And he also accessed the site on his iPhone while on duty. So that right there was kind of like, you said you only did this at night when you couldn't fall asleep.
Right.
Now you're doing it during the day while you're working.
If you think about that, if he accessed it 1,000 times in 1 year.
Right.
I mean, that's almost 3 times a day.
A day.
He went on that site.
Right.
That's a lot.
That is a lot.
It might not seem, like at first I didn't really think about it, but then I'm like, holy shit, that is a lot.
That's a lot.
You're going to this site repeatedly, over and over and over.
Yep.
It's becoming a compulsive behavior for him.
Yep. Now, Michael Wellner says that everyone charged with a crime will deny, rationalize, and distort facts and details to make their behavior seem acceptable.
Of course.
And he is no exception. No, he does it throughout the whole thing.
He does it to us the whole entire documentary.
Whole time. Yep. Gil even goes on to say that, you know, the time difference between here in England, where he was talking with Moody Blues, is why he'd be accessing the site, you know, during his daytime. And I'm like, okay. And the whole time he's fidgeting with his hands.
Yeah.
He looks nervous as fuck. I wrote, cannot stand this guy.
There's something about him.
He's so slimy. Yeah. I don't like him at all. Nope. Don't like him. We see some more on-screen text that says, according to Valley, he closed all of his accounts the night before Kathleen discovered the sites. Bullshit for sure.
Are you kidding me?
Oh, yeah. Oh, and he goes on. The amount of times that he tries to say that it's incredible how she found it the day after he shut all that down. If he had just shut it all down the day before that, and I'm like, I literally wrote down, whatever, fucktard.
I wrote down insert eye roll. Like, yeah. Come on, give me a goddamn break.
Well, and then the other part I said, this is where I wrote, the amount of times they share him eating is repulsing. I lost my appetite and I'm eating for two.
For sure.
I could not. There were chats found 2 days prior stating to Moody Blues that he had deleted or logged out of this website for, quote, less chance of getting caught.
Mm-hmm.
What the fuck? I don't know. I can't.
I know. And it's like, okay, well, isn't he on the site talking to Moody Blues? And he says that he closed out his account?
Yeah.
How are you talking to him still? Because the Dark Fetish Net was the main site that he was on with all of these people. He had went to these other sites as well, but that was like the main one. So that really didn't make sense to me.
No. So Dr. David Greenfield comes on to say that it was pretty lucky for him to get off on that defense, that he personally, as a psychiatrist, would not be surprised if Gil ends up in jail again.
Oh, yeah.
I kind of feel like this is like a red flag, like one of those things that now he needs to be watched.
Yeah.
That's my personal thought. Maybe he doesn't need to be in prison right now, but I feel like he needs to be watched.
For sure. And tracked a little bit.
Right.
His behavior needs to be tracked and what he's doing.
Yes.
Because he's obviously thinking very scary things.
Yes. And I feel like if he's ever found accessing these sites again,
right,
maybe that's a cause for concern.
For sure.
Now, Juror X, the woman that we met in the beginning, says that she felt betrayed by the judge, as this had not been an easy decision for them to come up to. She said the illegal use of the police database, they were all in agreement from day
for
one.
Sure. Yeah,
that
of course.
Was, he was guilty in that. But the conspiracy part was harder. And I get that. You have to prove conspiracy. And that's a hard thing to do. She says that the Moody Blues chats felt totally different when they had to read through them. And she said it was really hard to read and they had to read them over and over and over.
I know.
She says that it was very clear to her that he was taking steps to make his fantasy life become real. He had even made that trip to Maryland. It had been planned and indicated online as a quote unquote dry run. And it basically looked like he went there to obtain more information on her new life, where this woman worked, all of that.
Oh, scary.
And it's a road trip. So he's from New York. So they took a road trip to Maryland. Right. So it's not just a, 30-minute drive.
No.
When they returned, there was evidence that he went straight to his computer, logged on, and started chatting with Moody Blues as a, report on the trip, and had even mentioned her as looking, quote, mouthwatering.
Oh, that is so gaggy. Oh, my God. He also said that she was his favorite victim to fantasize over the last 10 years. So that's when we get that little tidbit that this isn't just happening within this year timeframe.
Right.
This has been happening for a long time.
It just took 10 years for him to get to the point of logging on and finding other people who felt this way.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We see some on-screen text that states 1 month into Valley's house arrest, the prosecution has notified the defense that they plan to appeal. Of course, it was expected.
Oh, yeah.
He was expecting it. His family was expecting it. Obviously, they're not just going to let him slide by and not go after him again. We see Alan Dershowitz again. Trash asshole.
Yeah.
He says that he was brought up by his father to always defend the underdog. And the underdog is the person on trial with all the resources of the state, the police, the prosecution being used against that person.
Sure.
Of course. So this would be Gil in this scenario. And juries are often unwilling to apply the presumption of innocence. I believe that. Like, it's hard for people to believe in the innocence when this person obviously got to where they are because of the evidence that was behind it.
Right.
Right.
Well, again, it goes back to us stating you're not innocent until proven guilty in this country. You are guilty until proven innocent.
Correct. And Alan goes on to state that we can't, as a society, err on the side of just putting people in jail. And I really feel like as a justice system, we have been doing that.
Yeah.
Because it's a safety thing. I think it comes down to the safety of the people as a whole. Is this person going to either actually commit a crime or commit more crime?
And I think it's more along the lines of a safety for their own ass. Because if this person goes out and commits a crime,
that too.
I don't think they're caring so much about the people it happens to. They're worried about the fact that, oh, it'll we let him go. Yep.
Right. Now, the line between fantasy and reality crossed when he saw Kimberly for lunch in Maryland. That's what the jurors thought, like you stated.
Sure.
And Robert Kolker comes back. He said that it's not clear that he was actually planning anything when you actually look at the timeline between when he searched his quote unquote victims in the database and when he chatted about them on the website.
Yeah.
So we see Kimberly Sauer. That was his friend that he met in Maryland. He had a search done on the database computer on July of 21st, 2011. The alleged conspiracy began on January of 2012.
Right.
So almost 6 months later, Andrea Noble, another friend of his, the search was done on his computer on July 20th of 2011. Again, the alleged conspiracy begins in January of 2012. We also see Maureen Hartigan. Her search was done on May 31st of 2012. She was never a target of the alleged conspiracy at all.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's not like he looked up their address and then the next day was talking about them on this chat line. But again,
was it a matter of time?
Yes. I mean, that's a hard one for me too. It's really a toss-up.
I know.
Now, he didn't give last names or addresses on the Dark Fetish Net. Thank God.
Ugh.
And Moody Blues had even asked for an address. And Gil just said, not sure on exact address. Yeah. So he probably wanted to play it off like he would give out the address, but he wasn't sure of it. So he couldn't give it out, you know? Now, was he just Googling her, but in the police database because he was bored at work? You can toss that out there a little bit too, because I'm sure cops do that. You know what I mean?
Maybe.
Just curiosity, and they're good people. It's not like they're trying to do bad things, right? But that could be it.
Yep.
And he doesn't believe that the jury convicted beyond a reasonable doubt. He's convinced that they convicted for that what if factor.
Oh, totally.
Now, police acted on this right away, but should have actually done an actual investigation. They never really did.
No.
They could have had a secret agent come out, a sting operation, like online to see if he would take it to the next level.
Yeah.
Would he ever meet with someone to actually carry this kidnapping plot out? Now, since this case, the police have actually done some sting operations from the dark fetish net and have convicted people.
Yeah.
But these were people who physically met up with these agents to plan a kidnapping. So they had taken that extra step, that
right.
overt act, right? They went farther than what Gil did.
Yep.
And one of them even created a kidnapping kit.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that was scary. I mean, they showed us all these items that he had planned to take with him to kidnap this woman. I mean, it's terrifying. There is a lot of people out there like that. Like, the world is a scary place.
No, it totally is.
Now, Joseph DeMarco comes back. He's that former federal prosecutor. And he says that reasonable people may say it's not enough to convict until he has all of the stuff and is heading to the victim's house.
Yep.
Reasonable people may also say that it's not enough until he has all the stuff and he's walking up to the door to ring the doorbell.
Right.
Some people may even say it's not enough until he gets in the house and goes up into a bedroom and sees the person.
Yep.
Right. Again, there's such a fine line between what people think, right?
Right.
Of what's actually guilty and what's not.
Yeah.
And what's conspiracy and what's not.
Yep. I mean, basically, do we want the government to be the people to decide what fantasies deserve to be criminally prosecuted?
Exactly.
Right?
I mean, can't live in a society like that.
It gets scary.
Yes.
It's yikes is what I wrote. Yikes.
Way too much government control at that point.
Oh, God. I think we have too much now. Right?
We do.
So we get some on-screen text that says, after more than 4 months under house arrest, Valley will be sentenced for illegal use of a police database. It's a misdemeanor offense. So he's wondering, you know, will the house arrest be over now? And will the government go through with their appeal?
Mm-hmm.
Will this be the start of thought policing? It's all very dystopic when you think about it. It's
for
scary,
sure.
Right? It's very like Hunger Games,
mm-hmm.
right? For context.
Absolutely.
We see some more on-screen text that says that Valley is sentenced to time served for illegally accessing a police database. He will be released from house arrest. Now, Lori Penny comes back to say what makes someone an ethical human being isn't what they think, but what they choose to do with those thoughts. So as ethical humans, we can have these dark thoughts, but never actually act on them.
Exactly. We were just talking about that.
Yes.
Like, thoughts come into our mind without us even consciously thinking of it sometimes.
Oh, yes.
You know what I mean? So how can you be prosecuted with something like that?
Oh, yeah. Do you know how many times I'd be prosecuted with assault from mentally punching the person in the face who is walking too slow down the grocery aisle?
For sure.
Right?
For sure.
So we see some more on-screen text that says, prosecution has until midnight to file the official appeal. So I'm going to sum it up because it gets boring here.
It does.
There's a lot of Gil walking around his house, checking this online site to see if the appeal has been filed, back and forth, blah, blah, blah. A countdown, 2 hours to midnight, 1 hour to midnight. Honestly, I was like, I kind of want to just skip forward to this part. Come to find out, it's a little after, I would say, midnight 30.
Mm-hmm.
I like using that term. And his mom comes down talking about how she realized it was after midnight and it was so quiet in the house, she was a little nervous. He calls his attorneys and find out that the prosecution had filed the appeal around 7:30 p.m.
I love that.
I loved it too. And he's like, we were looking at the wrong thing.
Because that is actually something I would do.
Totally.
I would be looking at something forever. And I'm like, why isn't this happening? They're like, oh yeah, you weren't even looking at the right page. I'm like, God damn.
You're not even in the right state. I would have been so screwed. So he says he's looking through it. They all have the same arguments as before, which obviously, right?
Yep.
There's been no new information. He's been in jail or house arrest since. So he said he's not really worried about it. We see some more on-screen text that says that the prosecution of Gilberto Valley continues. And then we see a little blip of 3 months later. He's walking down the street. He says he feels like he's been watched and that he's being watched, which, I mean, in all honesty, I kind of feel like he should feel that way. And in a way, I kind of feel like you should be watched.
Absolutely.
From this point on. He says that with the appeal looming and his notoriety, it's gotten a little bit more anxious. Then he starts talking about how he wants to get back to dating.
Oh.
And I was like, no.
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 That's going to be a tough thing for him. If he ever gets to date again, that's going to be really hard. Unless he finds someone who has a similar interest in this type of thing. BDSM, something like that, that can maybe understand it a little bit. Because I think right when he brings it up,
yeah,
goodbye, see you. Like, these right. ladies are running for the damn hills. Unless they can get past the fact that maybe it's just some dark fantasies and maybe they have the same fantasies. I mean, it's going to be hard for him if he ever finds anyone.
Well, and maybe he will. I mean, Gypsy Rose turned into a dark fantasy.
Yeah.
For her boyfriend.
For sure.
So who knows? Maybe he'll find someone stupid enough to act out for him. I don't know.
I did see that he has an Instagram.
Really?
He does. And he only has like 600 followers. I mean, it's not good. Like big. I thought that he might have more just because, I mean, this was national news,
right?
You know? So I was thinking people would try and search him. You can't really find him, though. If you look up his name, he doesn't pop up right away.
Yeah.
But I found it on a Google search. I Google searched and I was able to pull him up, and he's still posting and giving updates. But it's not like he has a huge following, and it still looks like he's single from what I can see.
I'm just surprised. I mean, even serial killers have groupies. So I just... Ugh.
For sure. This was quite an interesting case. What do you think about thought crime, Amy?
It scares the hell out of me. I feel like some of it is definitely a precursor, right?
For sure.
I mean, they have determined that some of the like, you know, triad of a serial killer, you know, part of it could be bedwetting. Part of it is, yes, you know, sadistic torturing of animals. And then, you know, so I do feel like some of it correlates.
I do too.
I don't like that he went with real people. Yeah. And fantasized about real people in his life. I think that's where it went beyond fantasy for me.
I think so too. And you know, like, I don't think that he should have spent the rest of his life in prison.
No.
For a thought that he had.
Right.
But that doesn't change how disturbing these chats were.
Right.
And again, it's all about that fine line. And did he cross it? It's hard.
And what is it?
Exactly.
What is the line?
Where is that line? Where do you cross it?
Well, I think we both agree. No jail, but he should be monitored from now on.
I agree.
Yeah. And there
for
should
for a long time.
For a very long time. And yeah. There should be things that will pop up red flags if he starts doing something. Do you know what I mean?
For sure. Thanks so much for listening to today's episode on The Cannibal Cop. Next week, we'll be covering the 3-part ID documentary, Jodi Arias, An American Murder Mystery. I am really looking forward to covering
this one.
Me too.
This one's a good one.
Yep. So don't miss it. Be sure to send any future requests to our personal email inbox, requests@sharecrimepodcast.com. Find us on Instagram @share_crime_podcast, Twitter @sharecrimepod, and our Facebook group, Share Crime Podcast Discussion Group. The meme sharing is pretty top notch, if
it
I don't say so myself.
Legendary.
And we'll be sure to keep you updated on all things Share Crime. We love you and appreciate you all. And don't forget, never run with scissors. Bye, guys.
Bye.